Yes, so Maitravanda is very impressed. He's given his life basically to the Dharma, to Sri Ratna, and to the London Buddhist Centre. He's been very consistent and loyal in his attentions at the London Buddhist Centre. He's been teaching there, I think, ever since he was ordained. He was ordained in 1990, so 25 years ago. He's been teaching the Dharma at the London Buddhist Centre and getting better and better and better at teaching the Dharma at the London Buddhist Centre. So it's quite a thing to hear Maitravanda teaching the Dharma. Recently I was on solitary retreat, and one of the things I did was listen to a series of talks or seminars that Maitravanda was giving on the theme of the book, actually. Although they're not like the book, because they were before the book was written.
Yeah.
They're very, very good, because he's both... he's someone who makes very serious points that are really strong, and he's got a real sense of humour, so that he's got everyone laughing. He gets everyone relaxed and laughing, and then he says what he says. So... yeah, and it's fantastic teaching ability, talent actually. Maitravanda's done lots of things as well as that. He put on an opera one time. He produced an opera, which was a madcap idea. It was very successful.
I don't recommend it.
Actually, we're going to have an opera here.
Yeah, I heard that.
Obviously, in more recent years, he's been writing. He wrote one book on friendship, Thicker Than Blood. He's written a book on mindfulness, Life with Full Attention. And he's written The Journey and the Guide. He's also published a couple of poetry books and various pamphlets and so on. So very versatile man. I'm delighted to see Maitravanda. I was joking with the team earlier that actually the reason I'm interviewing him is because I never get a chance to have a chat with him these days. So actually, it's not quite true. Maitravanda does have lots of time for his friends. In fact, he was telling me he's doing a lot of travelling at the moment, visiting various centres, doing interviews or talks or whatever. He was in Manchester last night. He'll be back in London leading a course on Journey and the Guide tomorrow night, and he'll be in Dublin at the weekend. But he was telling me that he likes to take somebody along with him if he's travelling, just to stay in touch with his friends and in touch with the London Buddhist Centre. So Nyamadeva is with him here. Hello, Nyamadeva. So let's start by giving Maitravanda a big round of applause, just to make him feel like... So the thing is, Maitravanda is very experienced at being interviewed. He's done lots of it. I have never interviewed anybody in my life. So this is a first for me. Hello.
That's good.
What should I ask? Well, the first question that came to my mind is, there's lots of books on Buddhism.
Yes, yeah.
Why another book on Buddhism? Why this one?
Could you hold it up?
I can hold it up. We're going to hold it up lots of times. It's The Journey and the Guide, just published.
Yeah, so there are lots of books on Buddhism. The real reason why I wanted to write this one was because I wanted to teach our system of practice. I've come to feel more and more strongly that we don't take ourselves seriously enough as a Buddhist tradition. I think partly because we wear the kesa. The word kesa is a derivation of a Japanese word that means a robe. But because we don't wear robes, we sometimes don't take ourselves seriously enough as a Buddhist tradition. And there's all sorts of things that we practice in our tradition that are quite distinctive to us. And I think are very important things. I mean, a very obvious example is something like rejoicing in merits, or telling life stories. They're all part of our system of practice. We've got our own particular system of practice. And then I went to a weekend led by Subhuti on the system of practice. And I thought, what we need is, well, especially after reading the papers, which papers that Subhuti and Bhante, for those of you aware, these things have been writing in the last few years, which are really absolutely central to our movement now. But a lot of people aren't reading them, They're quite dense, they're quite philosophical in some ways. So I wanted to write an accessible book that teaches our system, really. Right from the word go. Yeah.
And this is accessible.
I hope so, yeah.
So you've written this book in the form of a course, like is it an 8 or 9 week course?
Yeah, unfortunately, I just discovered a typo. It's got a week 9. There's not supposed to be a week 9. Anyway, how I didn't notice it when I looked at the proof, I don't know. But anyway, there's...
So why in that format? Why write it as a course? What's the idea?
I mean, I have mixed feelings about just about everything, including myself. And I have mixed feelings about a course book. The problem of a course book as a format is that it easily lowers the content, the intellectual content. I always find it a rather trivial form. so the obvious thing to then set off in 2.5 years to write one. But anyway, I think it is a slightly trivial form. Or it easily trivialises. But at the same time, I was very, whatever I wrote report before it, yeah. The journey, no, life that one, life of intention, that's done very well. Yeah. And a lot of people have been saying how much they're valuing the explicit, here's how you do it. So I wanted to teach I set out to teach our system of practice, and I wanted to both say what it was and how to put it into practice. And I wanted, and I still hope, that centres will run it as an 8 week course.
So you think that's better than actually just reading it from cover to cover? That people do it in groups?
If possible, yes. I mean, I'm always at pains to say it's a book, and most times you just read a book and you don't expect to put any of it into practice. You know, if you're reading Jane Austen, you don't expect to marry a duke or something, although, you know, the chance would be a fine thing. You don't expect to put it into practice. And you can read that book without, you know, any assumption that you're going to put into practice. But Buddhism is primarily something you do. I'm increasingly feeling that Buddhism isn't a subject. I don't think mindfulness is a subject. I think if you think of Buddhism as a subject, it attracts a particular kind of mentality. It's a bit like someone studying football. You just think, well, surely the point is to play it. And so I wanted to... The point of Buddhism is to practice it. So, in a way, I like it from that point of view, having a course book. But I am a bit... I think we have to be a bit careful of that. You know, that there needs to be... I think there still needs to be a full-out Buddhist philosophy book, for instance. I couldn't write it. The only way I could write it is if Subhuti does a series of lectures on it, then I could do a pop version of it. That's all I could do, but I couldn't do it myself. But we do need that kind of book as well. But anyway, it seems popular.
So have you written this primarily for people in Sri Ratna, or also for people outside?
No, I never do that if I can help it. Anyone who writes probably tries to write for everyone. And of course, publishers usually say if you write for everyone, you're not writing for anyone. You can't write for everyone now. Even that idea is to do with a particular idea of culture and what, you know, it probably won't attract a great Islamic audience, for instance, you know, or devil worshippers or whatever. But I do want to try and talk to as many people as possible. So what I've tried to do is say what I think are, well, not I think, what Bhante Sangharakshita thinks are the great stages of any human evolution, human flourishing. And then at the end, as an appendix, I've said, and this is what it looks like in this context. I've wanted to then say, well, this is where you'd ask to be a mitra, this is where you'd ask to be ordained, this is where you do the six element practice. But I do that in an appendix. I still think that the six great stages, great principles, five, not six, five great stages, are the stages of anyone's life who wants to make the most of their life. I don't like the word spiritual anymore. I've tried to get rid of that, but... it's so fluffy and over-earnest and slightly sanctimonious.
You've used this as a course already, or before you wrote it, or why did you want to use it?
Yes, so I I, as you know, I think out loud. Yeah. I'm an extroverted something.
Yeah.
Probably extroverted most things. Yeah. And I think out loud, so I do my best thinking in front of a room full of people. So before I tried to write it, this time I did a series of seminars on the stages to find out if I knew what I was thinking about. Mm. And then, of course, I think I did, and then I started writing, and then I realised I didn't. Mm. As soon as you write, it really puts you to the test of... Like I thought, oh, well, I know what integration is, so I started writing about integration. No idea what integration is. When you actually... One of the problems, as it were, problems of Bhante's elucidation of the Dharma is that it looks so simple. Yeah. And unfortunately, because it looks so simple, you think it is simple. You can even think it's not very profound because it's simple. But it's only when you come to write about it, you realise that it's much more intellectually difficult than you thought and extremely demanding. But it's just this, somehow, because Bhante's style is so simple and straightforward, I think we miss that. But when you write about it, you realise you really don't understand it. And that what Bhante expects of us, especially order members, I mean, like, he expects our ordination to be above and beyond lay or monk, not somewhere wishy-washy in the middle. You know, he expects us to be something new in the world. You know, when you realise how demanding it is, it's really quite terrifying.
Presumably you did come to know what integration is by...
Only sort of. I think I got a grip of it by the time I'd written those chapters.
I read this book, I've read it once and I've skimmed through it again.
Oh gosh.
And I really enjoyed it, I must say, I really liked it. One of the things I like about Maitreya Vanda's writing is like his talking, as it were, he's got lots of really good images and anecdotes to illustrate the points. And I don't know if I can find something here. For instance, there's a little section here on meditation. Says, generally speaking, meditation has a positive but soft press. It tends to be linked with well-being and being kind to yourself. But this makes meditation sound like a spa pool, sound more like a spa pool than anything especially life-transforming. Of course, meditation does include relaxation and well-being, but the tendency to think of meditation as some sort of jacuzzi for the mind creates problems.
It's quite good, isn't it? Jacuzzi for the mind. Who wrote that rubbish? You did.
And you go on to make a point about anyone can meditate.
Oh, yeah,
that's a very good point.
Yeah,
say something about that.
It's just interesting. I mean, partly all of my writing comes out of teaching at the Buddhist Centre at LBC for so long, for 25 years. I mean, I think I taught pretty much every week in my life since I've been ordained. Very unusual if I haven't.
Yeah.
And so many people say, I can't meditate. Mm-hmm. Or they say, my mind is too busy to meditate. Or they've got some idea that they need a wholly different mind, like a meditating mind, before they can meditate. It's got a very odd idea that you need to have a sort of... You need to be like almost just about to slip into deep meditation to qualify to be able to meditate. So I really wanted to make it very clear that anyone can do it.
Anyone can meditate.
If I can do it, crumbs.
He says it's not difficult or weird or navel-gazing, and no, you don't have to... You don't have an especially busy mind.
Yeah.
Your busy mind, the one that makes you think you'll never be able to meditate, that mind is the same mind we all have. You, me, the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker.
Very good. Such a gross approach.
Another image you use is for the kind of gradual nature of spiritual practice. You use the image of a caterpillar. We need to be like a caterpillar moving from one lettuce leaf to another. Most of our suppers will be attached to this day-to-day world of getting and spending, but some will be climbing onto the new world of spiritual life. We just need to keep transferring our weight gradually from one leaf to the other. This is why cultivating joy and delight is so important, and making friends and so on. But I thought it was a really lovely image for the kind of gradual nature of...
I nicked it from Bhante, I think.
Did you?
Yeah. All
right.
I mean, so much of it is because I've read so much of Bhante that it's all become sort of digested. I think some of the colour in it is not quite Bhante's, but I think the metaphor is his.
Right.
Does anyone remember? I've got it from somewhere.
I can't remember. Goff's boots somewhere.
Yeah, I'd nick that from Sabuti. I just nick stuff. Can you try and find something that I said?
Obviously, all the big time.
Yeah, this is a marvelous bit. Oh, that's Sabuti as well. Oh, this is another marvelous. Yeah, that's him as well.
Okay, one thing I really. The thing I enjoyed most about the book, though, I haven't mentioned at all, and that's the essays on poems.
Oh, yeah.
Interspersing the chapters, there's Maitreya Banda has a poem, and then he's got an essay elucidating that poem, drawing out a dharmic point from the poem. Mm. And I really enjoyed those essays for a couple of reasons. One, I like poetry, but there's something about the way you drew out you made the poem more alive, and you drew out the message from it. Mm. So I'd like you to talk a bit about the first one, the Niagara River. You could just maybe
read it
and say a bit about it.
This is a poem by Kay Ryan, an American, contemporary American poet. I've been in contact with her a bit because I bought her selected poems and I was so impressed by it, I wrote to her publisher and invited her to the Buddhist Center, and she said she'll come watch when she flies over. So, the Niagara River. As though the river were a floor, we position our table and chairs upon it, eat and have conversation. As it moves along, we notice, as calmly as though dining room paintings were being replaced, the changing scenes along the shore. We do know this is the Niagara River, but it is hard to remember what that means. Very simple little poem. So clever, isn't it? Because it's called the Niagara River. And you think, there's something funny about that. Niagara River. But you don't clock it enough. And then we do know this is the Niagara River, but it is hard to remember what that means. It's a brilliant condensation of our knowledge of impermanence, isn't it? We do know, and she repeats it, we do know this is the Niagara River, but it is hard to remember what that means. It's hard to, we do know that our life is flowing towards the falls, but it's just hard to remember what our knowledge means. It's a brilliant condensation of our human situation in that very slight poem. But also those, as calmly as dining room paintings are being replaced. I was thinking afterwards, I didn't say it in there, but it's actually a wonderful image for our fabrication. So that, you know, from a Buddhist point of view, there isn't a really existing world and a really existing me in the way we usually think of it. We're fabricating the world all the time. So it is like, instead of thinking of this completely changing, graspless world and from a graspless non-self, we fabricate it into pictures that are all just being replaced. Brilliant little short poem. Wonderful thing.
I must say, when I read the poem first, I didn't get any of that out of it. It was fantastic to read the essay afterwards. All of that, you know, how it relates to Keats.
That's very strange.
All the rest of it.
And yeah, she's got Keats in mind.
And then I also was struck by the last, I think it's the last one. I don't know how you pronounce the person's name.
I think it's Kavafi, but
Kavafi, who is an ethnic Greek who lived in Alexandria in Egypt.
That's right,
in the late 19th, early 20th century. Prolific poet. And the poem is called Ithaca. I won't ask you to read it, it's basically, the poem is about cherishing the journey. Do you want to say a bit about it, or is there anything?
Well, I wasn't originally going to use it, because I decided I should keep not use any translations, because how do you select poems? When I selected the poems for it, I wanted the best, you know, very good poems. I reread it and was really struck by his brilliant understanding that, you know, it's this sort of mythical journey to Ithaca, and the whole poem is about how, by the time you get there, you realise it's a journey that's been important. And he does that with such tact and beauty that it makes you relish the journey.
It says, as you set out for Ithaca, hope your road is a long one, full of adventure, full of discovery. Lystrigonian Cyclops, angry Poseidon, don't be afraid of them. You'll never find things like that on your way, as long as you keep your thoughts raised high. as long as a rare excitement stirs your spirit and your body.
I thought that was very interesting, that Laestrygonians, however you pronounce it, Cyclops, they won't hurt you as long as they're not in you.
Yeah.
If you don't have them in you, they won't, you won't meet them out of you. Yeah. Fantastic poem, lovely poem. The wonderful poet, Cavafy, very beautiful, very sad.
So how did you choose the poems? Did you...
Yeah, it's a bit tricky because there's so many, many poems to choose. And I didn't choose them because I like poetry, although I do. I really wanted, because the essays on poetry are on spiritual receptivity, and I really wanted people to experience receptivity rather than read about it. So the thing about a poem is you have to be receptive to read a poem. You can't speed read a poem. You can't plunder it for what it means. You have to savour it. So that's why I put them in. And then it was a question of which ones. And it was mostly the ones that struck me and that I thought I might have something to say about. There were so many. There was going to be another one by Marianne Moore, which I'd like to have used. I thought 8 poems were enough for most people.
So I recommend the book to you and the poems. I'm going to use the poems as a way of moving on to talking about your other book, which is the poetry book called Yarn. This is the second poetry book you've had published by Blood Axe, who are the major publishers of...
One of three, one of three. Carcanet, Faber and Blood Axe.
Yeah. So I was saying in the introduction that I've known Maitre Bandhu a long time, but actually, most of that time, I didn't know he was a poet.
So did I.
Never seen him. So, when did you begin writing poetry, and when did you start taking it more seriously, and why?
I began writing. I remember writing a poem when I was about 7, called The Hazelnut Tree, and my auntie refused to believe that I'd written it.
Right.
I remember it really. One of those early occasions when an adult won't believe you when you're telling the truth. I remember being quite staggered. I just thought, I can't. I don't know what to do now. But I did write it. No, you didn't. Very strange. Anyway, it didn't wound me for life. You know, we were fine. Nobody needed me to write poems anyway. You know, what they needed me to do is be able to do math, which was impossible. Anyway, so we were fine. But so I like many people, I've always written poems when I'm unhappy.
Yeah.
I mean, ever since we've been friends, I've been writing poems in my little notebook, you know. I've been saying, basically, they were, I'm unhappy and a blackbird is singing. Or, I'm a blackbird is singing and I'm unhappy. Take your pick. You know, Larkin famously said, doesn't he, that happiness writes white.
Yeah.
You know, so you don't write when you're happy. So I've, for many years, you know, all the time we've been friends, I've written poems in my notebook. But it's always embarrassing to write poems. It feels hubristic to write poems. You know, it's embarrassing, especially if you come from the West Midlands, as I do. So I didn't do anything with them. I never took them, tried not to take them seriously, and I tried not to read them to people, which I'd recommend. You know, if you do write poems, try not to read them to people as an act of compassion. Because Buddhists need to be practicing metta. Anyway, so I tried not to read them to people, not always successfully. And then... I typed some up one day in a mad moment and showed them to a friend of mine, and she was Vishantra, and she was very complimentary. And then I went on a poetry writing course, slightly embarrassed by myself. And then I won this mentoring prize, and then things.
So when you wrote them up and showed them to Vishantra, what was the catalyst for that? Suddenly, you.
Oh yes. Yeah. Well, the catalyst was I was on a 7-month sabbatical. I'd taken a sabbatical from my life at the LBC in Spain. I went to write a book on Buddhism and art because, you know, I got involved in Sri Ratna as a painter. I was at art school at Goldsmiths, and I've been trying to write this wretched book on Buddhism and art all this time. I'd tried this about the 3rd or 4th attempt. So I'd gone to this sabbatical. I was going to write this book at last, and I spent the first 3.5 months every morning, you know, for like 3 hours writing this book. I'd written about half of it. And then my good friend Jan of Arta came to stay with me for a week, and gave him the manuscript. And he read the manuscript very kindly and came back and said he wasn't impressed with the manuscript or with me. So Right. And he said, I think you should stop writing it. It was actually making me thoroughly miserable. I don't know why. It was making me thoroughly miserable. But I believed that I should push through that and write, you know. So I promised him that very moment that I would not write anymore. And I've never looked at that book again. In fact, I've even lost the transcript. I mean, it's very unusual. I mean, because my whole being said, no, I want to write, it's really important. But I just said, okay, I won't write another word. So I spent the rest of the time there much more happily, meditating more. I painted more. And I started writing I was reading a lot of poems. I was reading Heaney, I think, at the time, and Auden. It was then that I started typing them up, because I hadn't got anything to do. So I thought, I might as well type one up, you know. And they looked nice on the page. And as I said, I got back and then I showed them to Vishvantara. She was really encouraging. And all I needed was, you know, a tuppence worth of encouragement and I was off. Yeah. And then it becomes a kind of obsessive compulsive disease, you know. that's how it happened. And then, I mean, I'd been reading seriously before then. You remember me reading.
Yeah.
So, you know, David Mitra read me famously the first five verses of The Mask of Anarchy in his blood-curdling voice. Yeah. I had a dream in Italy, you know, and so forth. And I just thought, God, that's fantastic. Yeah. So I read all of Shelley and then read The Pursuit, Richard Holmes' wonderful biography, and then I read all of Keats, and I read Gittings' biography, and then I read The Divine Comedy three times. You'll remember me reading The Divine. I read it once without notes, once with notes, and once without notes. And it's quite long. And then I read all of Coleridge, and so I was reading a lot. And I suddenly started thinking. And then once I'd started typing them up and started, especially when I had this mentoring with Mimi Cavati, that was a real turning point probably. I remember her looking at one of my poems, early poems, and she said, I've been working for ages. She said, I don't think this is a poem. The next... I think for me, one of the turning points was a poem I had in the first collection. She said, yes, this is good. I like this poem. I've got nothing really to say about it. But why isn't it wonderful? And I thought, why is it? I thought it was such a good question. Why isn't it wonderful? Because often the problem with poems is there's nothing wrong with them. There's just not enough right with them. So she said, why isn't it wonderful? She said, well, one of the reasons it's not wonderful, it's not in meter. So she said, look, the first line of that paragraph, that's in pentameter, so is that... I think it wants to be in blank verse. So then I had to go off and learn to write in blank verse. Or another poem I talked to her, she said, I think this is trying to be a sestina.
Yeah.
And I nodded, yes. I didn't know what one was. Sounded like a curry. Or an Italian, something. You know, it's a kind of pizza. Would you like to order a sestina? So I rushed home and Googled it, you know, what is a sestina? And then, you know, tried to write a sestina, which, you know, is deadly difficult. But for me, the technical problems, and this thought, why isn't it wonderful? Because it's not, for me, it's not worth trying to create anything. You know, as a painter, you're always trying to make it wonderful. I remember my old painting tutor, she said, if it's good enough, it's not good enough.
Right.
I think that's absolutely true of all art forms. If it's good enough, it's not good enough. It has to be wonderful. And if you're not trying it to be wonderful, you shouldn't try.
Do you think some of the poems in Yarn are wonderful?
I think one might be.
What does it mean to you to be a published poet? And what does it mean to others? I mean, are you famous? Do you open some markets?
No, not at all. It's a ridiculous thing to do, write poems. Nobody reads poems. Do you know anyone that reads poems? You know what I mean? Anyone that reads poems, they read the great poets, quite rightly. And hardly anyone reads them anymore. Those that read contemporary poetry, nearly all of them read Seamus Heaney. Mm-hmm. And nobody else. So there's only about three people left, and one of them's, you know, one of them's me. So it's such a minor form now. So it's a mad thing to do, write poems. But for me, I've always had... I seem to need a directly creative work. I can't... Banti talks about his memoirs as being semi-creative, which I think is very his usual tact and accuracy. And I feel that about writing The Journey and Guide. I try and be as creative as possible. I try and write it as well as possible. But it feels semi-creative, whereas in a poem is trying to be fully creative. I don't suppose it means anything very much to other people.
Well, it does. I was just thinking of Poetry East.
Oh, yeah.
That presumably has given you a way into...
Oh, yes, that's true.
...other poets.
Yes. Yeah. I'm very pleased with that. I've started this Poetry East, you know, where I've invited... You know, many of the UK's best known poets to come. I'm just increasing it to, and I've got Michael Frayn coming a week on Saturday, you know, a very well-known playwright, and I've got Rowan Williams coming, the ex-archbishop, next year. So it's given me... I've got to know a lot of these people, quite well. It's opened up a whole new conversation to me. With people who are very, very serious about their work. And of course I want to bring the Buddhist... I want with Poetry East that gradually over the years we assume that any cultural question, and you'd want to know what the Buddhist perspective is. The instinct is, the Buddhist will have something interesting to say about this, something meaningful, relevant, directly applicable, not queered by secularism, but not hung up on theology, but some real perspective. So that's what I've hoped I've achieved, if anything. I love writing poems when they come. Working on them is very hard, but it has improved my teaching. It's improved my language. I mean, you're always having to use words. And the more beautiful the words are, the more accurate they are, the more creative they are. I mean, poems are only frozen speech. So it's improved my teaching. It's given me a deeper purchase on language, I think.
Let's have a look at a poem or two from this. Maitreya Bandhu asked me just pick the ones. There are quite a lot of Buddhist poems in here. Interesting. There's quite a couple of long poems. One called something to do with a farmer.
The Cattle Farmer's Tale.
The Cattle Farmer's Tale. And one called Travellers to or From Orissa.
From Orissa.
They're long poems based on stories from the Buddhist scriptures. Then there's a whole section of poems about Mahananda, who's an order member Maitreya Bandhu and I knew, who died a few years ago. So there's quite a lot of poems about that. And poems about your family, poems about being gay and coming to terms with that in the Midlands, in a village in the Midlands. The one I like best is Two Walks Home from School. And then there's one about your mother driving, and I do like the big ones. We probably won't have time for a lot, but maybe I'll ask you to read Two Walks Home from School.
Oh yeah, so this is a Sestina. This isn't a Sestina that I've written two. The first one, it's not in the collection. So Sestina, it's usually in blank verse, so it's in pentameter, and that. It has however many six, is it six, one, two, three, four, five, six, six verses of five lines where the end word comes in a set pattern. So as soon as you've written the first verse, you know exactly where the end words of each is. So it goes one, two, three, four, five, then I think five, one, two, four. You repeat them in a set pattern that you can't change, and then you have an envoy at the end.
Like mathematics.
I know. What is it about that? I described to a friend of mine, he said it sounds like mental self-harm. And then at the end you have what's called the envoy, which has got all six key words in it. Has to have all six key words in it. Sometimes in a set form, but sometimes you're allowed to just get them in anywhere. So it's called a fixed form. In other words, as soon as you set out to write a Sestina, it has to look like that. Right. You know, and it can't go longer. You can write a double Sestina like Spencer, where you have the envoy right at the end, but that's even more difficult. So you have to have this repeated form of words, yeah? And form in poetry is always an extension of content. If it's not, it's not form. So what you see, what a form does, it keeps on repeating itself. It's about something obsessive, something that you can't stop thinking about, something that you can't resolve, that you keep on going over the same things again and again. It's like knocking on a door that never opens. Mm. So that's what, and the form should be. The content needs to be a sestina. You can't just think, what do I do? Oh, I fancy writing a sestina. It has to want to be a sestina. Yeah. Anyway, there you go. That's a bit of technical background. Two walks home from school. Something was wrong. I knew it right away. Walking home with my junior school report to show my mum and dad some bad news on the final day of term, like when I stopped at a friend of mine's to watch The Wrestlers on TV. And how I knew that it was wrong. As soon as I sat on the sofa, my body was wrong. While their muscled bodies writhed away in front of me, blonde and suntanned wrestlers foiling in a coil of arms, the school report I carried home, not knowing why I stopped, why time had been suspended, while the news flickered blue around me, my body's news that made me tense and still. It wasn't wrong for them. My friend's father always stopped to watch the wrestling, but I couldn't turn away while they snatched and grabbed, the smacked report of chest on chest, shouting now what wrestlers meant to me, their writhing backs, what wrestlers put upon a schoolboy once the news was out and muscle had its say. The report was news to me, as though my blood was wrong. Trembling and intense, carried away on bruising skin and sweat, and how they stopped for a moment clinging. My parents stopped to open my report. I thought of wrestlers. My father said I'd have to move away to another school. I focused on the news of how they forced each other down, how wrong it was, the teacher said in my report, that I could barely read, the worst report, my being so far behind. The wrestlers stopped and were made to stand apart like it was wrong. What could my teachers say about the wrestlers? I teemed and ached while on TV the news showed stories where truth was turned away, like something wrong. Now my life was news. The school report, the wrestler's response, and how when I walked away, I saw my future stopped. So you can hear those repeating words, stopped, wrestler's away, report, wrong. News.
It's also quite autobiographical because it's about a young teenager coming to terms with his sexuality.
Yeah, yeah.
And two, as far as I know, it's quite true that you got really bad school reports.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And even they thought you were quite backward.
Well, in those days they thought I was educationally subnormal. Yeah. Terrible word, I was ever. Yeah. But the school report I was carrying home was one that was recommending that I'd be sent to a special school for people who were educationally subnormal.
Which is extraordinary, isn't it? That they're saying you couldn't read and
you're
writing poetry, writing sestinas.
I couldn't read. Yeah. I mean, I was terribly far behind. I mean, I was actually about 8 or 9 at the time, and I still couldn't read or write very much.
And you're dyslexic, aren't you?
I'm dyslexic, yeah. Yeah. And then I remember, and it was about the same time I stopped on the way back, and the wrestlers were on TV, and I remember feeling this intense response to it and thinking, this should not be happening.
I think that's a fantastic poem. I really enjoy it. Yeah. We just have a couple short ones because how are you doing? Are we all right? Yeah? So let's have my mother driving.
Oh yeah. It's nice to write a poem about my mother.
This is a shorter one.
This is actually, would you believe it, a sonnet, but it doesn't particularly show up as one. It's called My Mother Driving. The only thing to explain, I sent it to my brother. I said, hey, good on you, mate. Yeah, really good. Didn't understand it. It means what it says. He said, so what does it mean when you said my mother was never one of the avant-garde? I said, oh, no, that isn't very clear, no. So I don't know what that means. And I said, No, that's my fault. That's the poem's fault. My mother was never one of the avant-garde of feminism. I think it sort of makes itself clear, but...
Your mother was a bus driver.
Yeah, my mother was a bus driver, you see. I once said that she was in the vanguard of equity feminism, but she didn't get it. My mother driving... My mother was never one of the avant-garde, though she'd reverse coaches up our yard with the best of them, left hand down a bit, such were the days of oil and Duraglit. A small woman with pale and freckled arms, 5 children, and working for the coach firm, she drove so fast, my father would have to say, "We might enjoy the countryside today if only your mother would slow down." The run to Perrenporth was long and through the night. B roads, lonely windscreen wiper sound, with 4 boys in the back, an Alsatian, my sister on my father's lap. She'd wait until he nodded off, then put her foot down. It's the only slightly comic poem collection.
The poem on the other page behind that is called Mushrooms, and I think it's the two of them went together for me because right, about the relationship between your mother and father.
Yeah, and this
is when your father is dying, elderly and ill.
Yeah. In a way, this whole sequence of poems is really a sort of energy. It's for my father, in a way. He died many, many years ago, but it's been haunting me since. I've never read this one, actually, so it's nice. So it's called Mushrooms. Apart from me, no one played the baby grand, and I only played it in order to protest. The piano blocked the dining room. We had to squeeze around it to feed the tinfoil barbs. I electrocuted once, clearing out the tank. So when you came home in a hospital bed, stationed in the lounge and rigged with cot sides, we were used to furniture that didn't fit the room. The grandfather clock that never worked. The dining table with an extra central leaf. But what took us by surprise was how you held my mother's hands and told her that you loved her. And that as far as mushrooms went, they were only good for being kicked down by the cows. I mean, part of the poignancy of that is, actually, the thing I wanted to write about was that just as he was dying, he asked me to make him some toast. And he said, "Don't butter it straight away, let the toast cool down," because he didn't like melted butter in his toast. You know, he was 83, and I never knew that about him. Mm. And the simile with the mushrooms, it was only late in life I realised he didn't like mushrooms, and said that they were only good for being kicked down by the cows. It's a lovely sort of thought, isn't it?
Well, I like the two poems together, because in one, your dad is complaining about your mother's drowning.
Yes.
And the next one, he's saying, telling her that he loves her.
It's so unlike him. Yeah, yeah. Unbelievably unlike him to do that. Yeah. Upset my mother terribly.
Him saying that.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, I think we'll finish with just a section from one of the Buddhist poems. So this is...
The Travellers, probably.
The Travellers from Orissa. And it's a long poem, and it's 9 pages long. But I'm only asking you to read a short little bit from there to there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah? You could say, if you want to say something about the overall poem.
I mean, this poem, it's taken me 6 years to write. It's a nightmare. It's in blank verse with occasional rhyming couplets when it intensifies. It's a shaggy dog story, really. And just started again listening to Bhuti. He's become something of a muse almost. But he was giving a talk and he talked about the Travellers from Orissa. Mm. And I just thought, there's a poem in the universe somewhere called The Travellers from Orissa. It's so beautiful. And also I didn't know the story. Mm. So that provoked me to write it. And there's nothing known about them apart from that they're supposed to be the first people who they gave the Buddha the first meal after his enlightenment. But nothing's known about their story. Except for in Orissa, there's a strange subset of Hinduism there where they worship a god called Dharma. Mm. So there's a suggestion that they really were travellers who met the Buddha and did sort of communicate something. So of course that's made lots of people try to write their story. And what happened with this is I wrote it, I even published it, and I showed it to Carol Rumens, a very, very good poet and a very, very good critic, and she said, something wrong with this. She said two things. Firstly, she didn't like the fact that I just called him the master. She said, that's a literary term. You wouldn't. Why have you called him the master? And that set me thinking about, why did I call him the master? And she said, this is an unreliable narrator, and you haven't told us what's really happening. So it provoked me, because I thought I'd said everything I could. And then this section is like 5 years later than some of the other parts of it. So this is where it's told from the point of view of an old man. Told from the point of view of an old man, remembering when he first met the Buddha when he was young. He's told the whole story, as if from start to finish, and told you what's happened. Then, as an old man, he and Magia, who I've made Magia his son, because I rather liked giving Magia a backstory sort of thing. And Magia is a very important figure to us. He's gone with Magia to meet the Buddha as an old man, and the Buddha's remembered his name. Says his name. And he finds it unbearable and breaks down crying. And then Magia, as they walk home, wants to know why he's crying. And suddenly he tells the story again and says things that you thought he told the truth and he hadn't. So that's what this section is. So this is him telling Magia the truth of what actually happened, although as a reader you think you've already been told the truth. Perhaps I'll read a little bit earlier just to get there. I'd kept the secret feeling to myself ever since that day I told Karangi, knowing I'd not be understood and doubting if I would be now. But I was overawed, meeting the master, and weary from the road. So I opened up my heart, trusting to the gods. Everything was true about the place, I said. The forest grove, the food I went and fetched. But after we had eaten, and after Tapusa had gone through all his questions once again, and hardly listened, and had no more to say, the master said, I remember every word, I've kept them with me all this time. He said, listen, my friends, there is a thorn buried in the heart of man. And for this thorn, they suffer here and now, and in the future. I have found that thorn and plucked it out, and for me the mass of suffering is no more. Tapusa jumped in, saying, yes, but, I could have struck him, and quickly said his name, but the Lord, for so he seemed to me just then, looked at him with such a heart of love, I couldn't speak. And then a wonder came, and troubled me, and worked within my soul, as if I'd rise and shout, and stamp my feet. But then I saw Karangi's face, the boys, the village fields I'd always known. How could I leave and walk the triple world with him? My heart was like a netted fish, thrown up upon a dusty bank and thrashing wildly. But the master, the happily attained, guide unsurpassed of men to be tamed, the blessed one, richly endowed, he seemed to search inside my heart and urge it forward. I didn't follow the Blessed One that day. I left with Tapusa, as I said, and walked back into my life and tried to take it up the way I'd always lived. Only Karangi knew that something deep inside had changed. And soon I found how little I could say. And soon I gave up trying, even with her. Tapusa hadn't understood. It turned the whole thing upside down and made it all about himself and how he stood and what he had to say. I'd kept a stubborn silence. And though I've loved my children one and all, Magia best perhaps, and though my life's been blessed, I won't complain. I knew as I climbed inside the cart, the sky still bright above my head and half the journey done, I knew that day that I had betrayed my life.